So this is my birthday episode.
Yay! Happy birthday, Sammy!
Now, granted, this comes out like, you know, a couple of days, or actually like over a week before my birthday. I guess probably the June 1st episode is closer to my birthday than the May 15th episode, because my birthday is May 27th.
I claim a month for my birthday, or at least 2 weeks for my birthday, too. I wouldn't say a month.
Okay.
2 weeks.
Well, so then
I will let you have it.
Okay, so this is my birthday episode. So
yay!
I will be celebrating my birthday on the 27th of this month, probably from quarantine. I don't know. Although, like I was telling Tess before we started recording, my state has actually started slowly opening things back up. So I might be able to actually go out and do something for my birthday, at least with like maybe a friend or something like that. So fingers crossed that, you know, my state keeps trending down, hopefully, you know.
Yeah. And you got your hair did.
And I got my hair did. So for you guys who haven't seen, I'm blonde now. I don't know if I posted that to any of our social media.
I don't think so. You need to.
For those of you who haven't seen, I am blonde now. I will post some of that to our social media. I got bored during the quarantine like everybody did. And I bleached my hair and it turned out really, really yellow. And then I went and got it fixed yesterday professionally, and now it looks really good, and I'm really happy with it. So I've never really done blonde like this before, so it was
it's been
fun. I'm happy with it. So
good.
But so what's new with you?
Oh my gosh, you know, my garden's still successful. I haven't killed it yet. That's awesome. And other than that, I wouldn't say there's really anything new in my life. I'm just staying healthy, and I would say that's a positive improvement.
Yeah. Yeah, things are
not that I'm not unhealthy. Not that I'm not unhealthy.
Yeah. Things are going all right for me as well. I'm still just, you know, playing Animal Crossing and binge watching Netflix. One of our listeners like reached out and was like, hey, you should come to my island in Animal Crossing. And I think I might actually do that. So if any of you guys have Animal Crossing and are playing it currently and want to visit my island or want me to come visit your island, hit me up, because chances are I'm already like on my couch playing it and would love to have somebody to play with. So
help Sammy travel. He has to travel somehow.
Hit me up. I would love to play with you guys. That'd be fun.
Nice. So nice. Yes. We happy hermits are happy to have you guys. We're back in your ears, and we're happy to be here. And let's see.
We're happy.
Any orders of business we should get to before we get into our conspiracies?
Well, we want to say a huge thank you to our newest patron, William.
Woo!
William, we cannot thank you enough, and any of our patrons, we cannot thank you guys enough for deciding that we're worthy of your financial support. That just blows our minds. We don't expect that from anybody, and the fact that you guys give that to us anyway is beyond any recognition that we could give you, and we're just so eternally grateful.
We really are. We're happy we get to do this for you guys. We're happy we get to be there. We're happy you guys have been interacting.
Yes.
And with us, we've got a surge of just people reaching out, and we just love it. It is the best part of our day. And
yes, we've gotten
like Amber and Mo the rat. Oh my God. I love
it. Yes, I love that.
I love it. I used to have rats and I loved them. And so I love you. And sister.
Yeah, we've gotten a lot of like emails and Facebook messages, and it's just been so much fun getting to interact with you guys and talk to you and hear about your life experiences and your cryptid things and your conspiracy theories. It's just been so much fun. So keep doing that, because that really like makes it even more special for us. So
yay.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you so much. So let's get down to business. If
yes.
you guys are new here, we are now toward the, I'm getting kind of toward the end of our
Fourth season. Yeah.
Oh my God. Already four seasons.
I know.
And we usually cover conspiracies and cryptids. I typically cover conspiracies. Tammy covers cryptids. But this time, this season, we have flipped the script. We're doing a swap a season. Mm-hmm. I'm covering cryptids and Sammy's got the conspiracies and he's been doing a wonderful job. He's been very historical.
You've been doing a great job, too. You found cryptids that I probably never would have covered. So I'm really excited. You've taught me about
that's a good thing.
No, absolutely. You've picked ones that I didn't know about or, you know, just didn't cover because I like to cover the well-known ones. So it's been cool to hear about some of the lesser well-known ones. So yeah, no, I've really enjoyed it. You've done a great job.
It's been fun traveling the world and we're going to do it again this time too. That's a tease.
It is a tease. So
it is time for a penny for our thoughts.
Yes, it is. And I think it's my turn this time.
Yeah, okay. It is.
God, I feel like at this point I'm like, I always pick heads or tails, but there's only two options. I'm going to go with heads.
Heads.
Okay.
So we get it. Yes. We start with a little bit of history.
Okay. So you guys, I took a deep dive this episode. My scripts are normally like, what? Oh, splash. You're making a splash noise. I thought you were shushing me. I was like, what? My scripts are normally like 6 pages long at the most, you know, maybe 7 if I'm really pushing it. But this episode, my script is like 11 pages long.
Oh boy.
I trimmed the fat too. Like, I started out like looking up this certain topic and then I trimmed it down to specifically like four stories inside this topic that specifically had conspiracy theories behind it. And even still, it ended up being 11 pages long.
Wow.
So I'm going to try to go through this as quick as I can because I don't want to eat up like an hour just on
eat
mine.
Eat away. I want to hear it. Please lay it on me. Okay. What else are we doing, guys?
I mean,
right?
That's
we're just
fair.
We're sitting and chatting.
So you guys might get an extra special long episode this week. I don't know yet, but it's looking like it might be. But this topic is one that I've wanted to talk about since you sort of touched on it in the Bermuda Triangle episode last season. So you mentioned like a bunch of different disappearances that happened in that area specifically. But there have been many cases of disappearing flights around the globe. So you talked about like disappearing ships and flights and people. I'm just specifically going to talk about disappearing flights around the world. So I'm not going to talk about any from the Bermuda Triangle. So those are some that I trimmed out.
Cool. Okay.
So these are
okay.
just different ones from around the globe.
Interesting.
So as you mentioned in that episode, there are many different reasons why planes can go missing. But because of the fact that we never find them, it leads us to create conspiracy theories as, you know, to explain such a jarring disappearance, you know, especially if something as big as an airplane, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
So I'm going to talk about, like I said, 4 different disappearances, but 2 of them are like probably the most famous plane and aircraft disappearances of all time, and those being Amelia Earhart and Malaysian Airline Flight 370.
Mm-hmm. So I remember that.
Yeah. So I'm going to save those 2 for last, though, but just know that those are coming. The first one that I'm going to talk about is the Flying Tiger Line Flight 739. This one happened on March 16th of 1962. Flying Tiger Line Flight 739, which was a military chartered Lockheed L-1049H Super Constellation carrying 107 passengers and crew, disappeared on its way from Travis Air Force Base in California, which is about 45 minutes from Sacramento.
Yep.
It was on its way to Saigon, Vietnam from Travis Air Force Base and disappeared along the way. So it was primarily carrying military members as part of a like relief mission to replace the soldiers that were currently in Vietnam, training the Vietnamese military to fight against the Viet Cong. So it was basically like a deployment flight. Uh-huh. You know, they were sending out the new,
yeah,
the new group of troops to replace the ones that were currently there.
Groups of troops.
Yeah. So the flight left Travis Air Force Base at around 7:36 a.m. Pacific Standard Time on March 15th and arrived in Guam at 3:14 a.m. on March 16th. So I had to go down a rabbit trail to find out these times because Wikipedia listed all the times in Greenwich Mean Time, which outside the U.S., I'm sure everybody understands Greenwich Mean Time, but we don't understand, you know, like
they don't teach us that.
We don't understand kilometers and, you know, the metric system. So most of us don't understand Greenwich Mean Time either. So I put it into Pacific Standard Time instead.
Perfect.
So for me to do that, I had to look up a Greenwich Mean Time calculator to find the times for Pacific Standard Time. And then they only listed the land time for the flight into Guam, but not the takeoff time. So I had to look up how long it would take a flight from Travis Air Force or from, yeah, Travis Air Force Base to Guam. But then I realized that that was using the flight speed for a current model aircraft.
That's
so
true.
I had to look up the cruising.
Oh my God.
I had to look up the cruising speed for the Super Constellation and plug that into the calculator to find out how long it would take a Super Constellation to fly from Travis Air Force Base to Guam, and then subtract that much time, and then use like a different calculator to subtract that flight time from the current time or from the land time in Guam.
Guys, this is so dedicated.
I have never done this much research before in my life for this podcast. But yeah, so that's how I was able to find out the takeoff time, or at least a rough takeoff time. But it was a fiasco. Also, my brother asked me to mention how far that distance was, because that did all these calculations did tell me. So
good point.
Right.
Good.
So
point.
A flight from California to Guam is 5,815 miles, which is also 9,358 kilometers. Or, and this is specifically for my brother, 85,286 and a half American football fields.
Joel.
So he specifically asked me to like measure it in football fields. And I was like,
I love it.
All right. I'm already on this weird rabbit trail. So sure. Why not?
Sure. Now I want to know how many footballs.
Oh God, no, we're not even doing that. But
in
but yeah.
a row.
But yeah, so that's what I had to do for this week's episode. I had to actually like look up times for 1962 and find out if it was standard time or daylight savings time, and then I had to figure out how fast this specific plane could fly.
Sammy is not occupied, guys.
I was bored, and this was last night too. So this is another one of our episodes where we're coming at you almost live.
Yeah.
I wrote my script the night of the 13th. We're recording the 14th, and you'll be listening probably on the 15th. So
in a matter of hours, we are last minute.
We are Lisa's. Professionals. I
yes.
tell you. But anyway, so this was all the work that I did. So I digress. So after getting some minor maintenance on engines 1 and 3, because this is a 4-engine propeller plane, just some, you know, minor maintenance upon landing in Guam, the flight departed at 4:57 a.m. headed for the Philippines. So it was in Guam for, you know, about an hour and a half, almost 2 hours. And they had an estimated arrival time of landing in the Philippines at 11:16 p.m. The pilot radioed in at 6:22 a.m. for a routine check-in, and then again at 7:30 a.m. However, due to heavy static on the Guam IFSS side, they were unable to establish contact. The Flying Tiger was never heard from again.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. The aircraft was declared missing later that same day, and the Air Force, Navy, Coast Guard, and Marines quickly dispatched aircraft and ships in order to begin search and rescue efforts. The search continued for 8 days and spanned more than 200,000 square miles or 520,000 square kilometers, which at the time was one of the largest searches to ever take place in the Pacific Ocean. However, the plane was never found.
Wow. I mean, an ocean's a big ocean.
Especially the Pacific Ocean. It's gigantic. Yeah. It's massive.
Gigantic.
It's like, what, 7,000 miles across or something like that?
I mean, I've been on even just a cruise ship and it, like, just going to, like, say Ensenada, and like, just they go just far enough away from land and you're like, I don't see land anymore.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I mean, if you've even flown in, like, I've gone to, like, say, like, Hawaii a couple of years ago and stuff, and it's just like, there's just ocean forever.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. When I was 16.
Until you hit land.
Yeah. When I was 16, my family took, like, a military flight over to Hawaii for, like, a vacation. And I actually, like, my brother and I got to go up in the cockpit and see what the pilot saw. And you can hardly tell the difference between sea and sky. The only way that you can really tell is because they have a radar thing on their screen that tells them what way's
up. They're still going straight. Yeah, exactly.
And that was,
I mean, can you imagine at night?
Even at, you can't see. I mean, even at 16, that was terrifying. But so anyway, the conspiracy theory herein lies in the fact that there were only two Flying Tiger Line flights with military connections, and they both had incidents on the same day. The second one was carrying, quote unquote, secret military cargo and caught fire and crashed in the Aleutian Islands on the same day. So due to the coincidence of both flights crashing or vanishing on the same day, it led many to believe that there may have been sabotage going on, or maybe even Flight 739 had been kidnapped.
I'll believe it.
Right? I mean, it seems a little fishy. So the executive vice president claimed that there was nothing powerful powerful enough on board either of the aircrafts to completely blow them apart, and that something violent must have happened. So... yeah, that's that's like all that I could find on that. So I did more research on there was more to be found about flight times than there was on the actual conspiracy theory itself. But that's the conspiracy theory. And they don't really know. Like they never found it. They found the other one because it did crash, know, inland. But they never found the other one. And because they didn't. Yeah, there is some conspiracy that because the only two military chartered flights through that airline went down on the same day that it might have been sabotage.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But who?
Right. Right. And it's kind of creepy. It's kind of creepy.
Maybe it was a helicopter company.
Maybe. Maybe. Or maybe just like a different military.
Maybe.
So the next one I'm going to talk about is from May of 2003. So this one was almost 17 years ago. It'll be 17 years ago on the 25th. May 25th, 2003, a Boeing 727 was stolen from the Quatro de Fevereno Airport in Luanda, Angola. Around 5 p.m. local time, American pilot Ben C. Padilla and Congolese mechanic John M. Mutantu boarded the aircraft. Both men had been previously part of the crew working on this aircraft in order to get it flight ready, but weren't qualified to fly this specific model, not to mention that the specific model of aircraft typically required a crew of three, not two. So these two men boarded the aircraft, and then without communication with the tower and without clearance, the aircraft taxied onto the runway and took off. Despite the tower attempting to make contact, they were unable to reach these two crew members, and the plane took off without any lights and headed southwest towards the Atlantic Ocean. The plane was fully fueled up and had enough fuel to travel 1,500 miles or 2,400 kilometers, and it was never seen or heard from again.
Oh, wow.
So they stole
it. It took off with two people stole it. And
they literally stole a Boeing 727. Like passenger airliner.
Wow.
Yeah. In 2010, thanks to Cablegate, which I don't know if you remember Cablegate, but it was a mass leak of classified U.S. diplomatic cables dating from 1966 to 2010 on WikiLeaks. So because of that, it was discovered that the U.S., including the FBI and CIA, searched for the aircraft in multiple countries, but nothing was found. Two countries in specific that were searched were Sri Lanka and Nigeria. And Nigerian diplomats said that it was unlikely a plane fitting this one's description could have landed in any of their airports because it would have been very easily recognizable.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah.
Huh. Hmm.
Yeah.
Wow. And just out of thin air.
Just out of thin air.
Poof.
Don't know what happened to it. As far as like the conspiracy theories go, there's only one again. Padilla's sister, Benita, stated in a 2004 article that actually there's two, sorry, that she think or her and her family think that the plane crashed somewhere in Africa and that he was being held hostage against his will. Aerospace sales and leasing president Maury Joseph agreed with that idea that the plane had crashed due to the fact that he had examined the plane 2 weeks before its disappearance and said that it wasn't like prepared to fly. That's why it was being worked on. However, okay. U.S. authorities believe that that sales and leasing president is actually to blame for the plane's disappearance because he had a history of accounting fraud. And they think that another company might actually have stolen the plane from him or crashed it intentionally as part of business fraud or a scam. So
come on.
So there's,
why can't come on.
Yeah. So apparently he was kind of a shady person and and people either think that a rival business stole the plane from him or that he, you know, hired people to steal it on purpose to file the insurance. So those are the two conspiracies with that.
Typical.
Yeah. So so those are those two conspiracies. Now I'm going to get into the famous ones like I mentioned. So the first one I'm going to talk about is Amelia Earhart, who is one of the most famous missing people on the planet.
I would love to know where she went.
Right? So after her first failed attempt at around-the-world flight, Amelia Earhart set out on her second attempt on May 20th, 1937. In her first attempt, she planned to fly west from Oakland, California. However, due to complications, they didn't make it past Hawaii before having to turn back and have her aircraft repaired. So in the second attempt, she decided to fly east instead, you know, kind of saving the Pacific Ocean for last instead of doing it right away. You know, that way, if any complications came up, they were predominantly over land and could fix it.
Good idea.
Yeah. So on May 20th, she began her second trip with an unpublicized flight from Oakland to Miami, Florida. And then upon arriving in Miami, officially announced her flight plan for this attempt. So she flew from like Oakland to like a down to like the LA area and then, you know, over to like Arizona, a couple of different hops, but it was predominantly Oakland to Florida was the first leg of the journey.
What year was this again?
1937.
Wow.
Right?
Picture those places at that time. And there's looks nothing like it does now.
No, I'm sure it doesn't.
Wow.
So on this attempt, the crew would only be herself and her second navigator, Fred Noonan. The first attempt was going to have a crew of three, but this one only had a crew of two. Which I didn't know that. I thought that she did it single-handedly. Yeah. But yeah, no, it was a crew.
I knew there was one, at least one other person with her.
Yeah, I don't know why I didn't make that connection because most planes back then had a two crew, you know, flight crew. But anyway, so it was her and her partner, Fred Noonan. They departed Miami on June 1st, 1937 and subsequently made multiple stops throughout South America, Africa, India, and Southeast Asia before making it to I hope I'm going to pronounce this correctly. Lae in New Guinea. And they got there on June 29th. So in the course of a month, they made it from Miami, Florida, all the way to New Guinea, which with an old prop job, that's actually pretty impressive, you know?
Yeah.
So by this point, there was only about 7,000 miles or 11,000 kilometers left of the journey, and it was the Pacific Ocean. So that was all that was left.
That damn Pacific Ocean is just too dang big.
It's too big. It's too big.
It's too dang big.
So their final legs of the journey would be Howland Island, Honolulu, Hawaii, and then finally back to Oakland. So New Guinea to Howland, Howland to Honolulu, and Honolulu to Oakland. So they were
– You can do it. You can do
it. They were so close. They really only had two stops left.
Mm-hmm.
So – Earhart and Noonan departed Lae Airfield on July 2nd with 1,100 gallons of gas, which I should have put that into liters, but I forgot, which was approximately 200 more gallons than they needed for this leg of the journey, just as a precaution. So, you know, this way they'd have 200 more gallons of gas to just fly around in case that they got their coordinates wrong, you know, and needed to find where they were going. So they had plenty extra. Also, in preparation for the trip to Howland, the U.S. Coast Guard sent a cutter, which is a small naval vessel generally designed for coastal defense duties. So they sent the Itasca to the island. So the and that was the ship's name, the Itasca. So the Itasca had communication and navigation functions, and the plan was that they could communicate with Earhart's aircraft via radio. They could transmit radio homing signals to make it easy to find Howland Island without precise celestial navigation. They could do radio detection, finding if Earhart or finding Earhart if she used her 500 kilohertz transmitter. Or they could use an experimental high-frequency direction finder for Earhart's voice transmissions.
Oh.
Or in case of ultimate emergency, they could use the ship's boilers to make, like, smoke signals, which would create, like, dark columns of smoke that could be seen over the horizon. So they had,
we had some neat stuff back then already.
Yeah. So they had multiple ways to find her or her or help her find them in case of an emergency. And none of these worked.
Oh, my gosh.
So that was, let's see, 6 different ways to find each other in case of an emergency. And none of them worked.
You can, it just goes to show that planning just never goes as planned.
There's always the possibility that, you know, of a worst case scenario.
Always. Always.
So on their approach to the island, the Itasca was able to receive loud and clear voice transmissions from Earhart. However, she was unable to hear them in return. So they could hear her, but it was like one-way conversation. At 6:14 a.m., Earhart requested that they use the direction-finding equipment, and she whistled into her microphone in order to give a continuous signal to help them, like, hone in on her voice signal.
Smart. Smart.
It didn't work.
Dang.
Then between 7:30 and 7:42 a.m., the Itasca received radio calls stating that Earhart had only about a half hour left of gas and that she couldn't see the ship anywhere despite flying as low as 1,000 feet. So they were super low and she still couldn't see the ship or the island she was supposed to land on.
Wow. Oh my gosh. Where the heck was she?
They think that she was probably about 5 degrees off, which at sea, that could be a big difference.
Yeah.
But they don't know for sure. That's just kind of a thought, is that, you know, like, she might have been anywhere from like 1 to 5 degrees off from where she was supposed to be, maybe more.
Wow.
At 7:58 a.m., Earhart requested Morse code signals to be sent as a way to track the ship's location. However, even though she did confirm that she received the Morse code signals, she was still unable to determine the location. So she could get, like, even though she couldn't hear them through the radio, she did get the Morse code signals. So the communication was working, but being able to lock on to where the signals were coming from wasn't.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
It must have been just so frustrating.
Oh, it must have been terrifying. I read one of, like, the ship's, or a quote from one of the ship's radio technicians, that they were sweating blood. Like, not literally, but sweating blood because they couldn't do anything. They were all just kind of stuck. They couldn't find each other, you know.
You can't just reach up and go, there she is.
Yeah. They couldn't see her. She couldn't see them. They could not find each other. Earhart's last known transmission was at 8:43 a.m., in which she stated their location and made it seem like they had found Howland's charted position, but that it was off by 5 nautical miles. So they were off by a lot. And it was at this point that the Itasca attempted to use the boiler smoke signals to attract the flyer's attention, but they couldn't see those either. So they really must have been way off course. They might have been near a different island, which would explain why they found the island that was 5 miles off.
Yeah.
It might have been a different island. And I'll get into that with the theories. After that, they were never seen or heard from again. And search efforts were carried out for 17 days before being finally called off and then being pronounced dead.
Wow.
And she was only 39 years old, I believe. Mm. She was really young. The three most common conspiracy or common theories are that the ship crashed over water and sank.
Yeah.
Or that they made an emergency landing on nearby Gardner Island, which is an island that is about 5 or 6 nautical miles away and could have been that we found the island, but it's off.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or that she was captured by the Japanese.
Oh.
Cause this was,
and then we wouldn't know where she was.
Yeah. Cause this was around the World War II timeframe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's true.
The first of these three holds the most weight. Obviously just that they crashed and sank in the water, you know, the second doesn't really have any evidence because there was no debris of a plane crash found on Gardner Island. There were human remains found there at one point, though they were recently tested and they were and measured and everything. And they didn't seem to. Well, at first they didn't measure Earhart's measurements. And then after like later discoveries in scientific, you know, medicine and stuff like that,
technology,
they figured out that it was a male skeleton, not a female skeleton. So it wasn't her.
Interesting.
So they don't know, but it wasn't Noonan's size either. So they don't know who it was.
I wonder how he got there.
Don't know. There were natives living on the island at certain points. So it could have been natives or just other settlers on the island throughout the years. And then the third carries probably the least amount of weight, because the Japanese would have had more reason to rescue the famous aviators because then they would have been lauded as heroes and it might have changed things during the war if they'd found these famous aviators trying to make world travel and returned them. It might have fixed some things, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So it's like,
yeah, you're right.
They probably wouldn't, like, there's no reason for them to keep them because it would have been more beneficial to return them.
Yeah, yeah.
So
true, true.
Yeah.
Interesting. I wonder where she went.
Yeah.
I bet she sank.
Probably. That seems the most logical. But we're going to get into some more bizarre conspiracy theories with Earhart.
Ooh.
So as far as the more out there ones go, one states that Earhart was actually a spy hired by President Franklin D. Roosevelt to spy on the Japanese. However, this theory can actually be traced back to a World War II era movie from 1943 about a fictional female aviator who was in fact inspired by Earhart, who was secretly a spy. So this movie came out and people were like, well, that makes sense. Maybe she actually was.
Well, if Hollywood says it's possible, then it must be, that must be true.
So even in the 1940s, we just believed everything Hollywood told us. That much has not changed.
No.
In, you know.
Gee, I wonder where we get it.
That much has not changed in 80 years. But another theory states that Earhart may have been compelled, like taken captive by the Japanese and compelled to be a Tokyo Rose, which I don't know if you're familiar with Tokyo Rose, but there was Japanese propaganda broadcast on radio back during World War II, and it was broadcast by English speakers to basically discourage Americans and their family or allied forces and their families that were in and around Japan. So
interesting.
Yeah, it was Japanese propaganda broadcast in English to discourage English speakers who were over there. And it, I don't remember if I read if they found her, but at the time they thought maybe it was a bunch of women.
Oh,
and yeah, they couldn't figure out if it was Japanese native women or if it was like people being held like prisoners of war, things like that.
Yeah.
So one conspiracy theory was that Earhart might have been one of these women compelled to be a Tokyo Rose.
That is out there.
Right? It was interesting. So that was a little history lesson that I'd never heard about was the Tokyo Rose. So, yeah, but I would suggest looking into that. It was kind of interesting. A different theory states that Earhart's plane crashed in New Britain, which is a small island northeast of Papua New Guinea, and about 2,200 miles or 3,500 kilometers away from Howland. This one doesn't really make sense, however, as Earhart was clearly very close to Howland at the time of her disappearance. Judging from her radio signals, she wouldn't have been able to be in contact with the Itasca from 2,200 miles away. The radio signals wouldn't have reached. And she wouldn't have had enough fuel to turn around and fly over 2,000 miles back the way she came. So, according to some people, they found like a downed aircraft on this island, but it just doesn't make sense because clearly she was close to where she was supposed to go and she didn't have enough fuel to fly back. So that one doesn't really have much weight, but that was a theory that circulated around for a while. And the like final conspiracy theory that I'm going to talk about is a really bizarre one. An author claimed that she had actually completed her journey in secret and moved to New Jersey and assumed a new identity of Irene Craigmile Bolam.
I believe that one.
She
didn't want the fanfare.
Well, you shouldn't. You shouldn't, because Irene Bolam, who was a real person and a New York banker at the time, obviously denied the claims.
Yeah.
And then also filed a $1.5 million lawsuit in damages, which in today's money is $27.4 million.
Holy cow.
In damages. Basically saying that, you know, he'd wrecked her reputation.
I believe it even more. Well, because she was hiding.
It's going to get better. The book that spawned this conspiracy was pulled from the shelves by the author in an out-of-court settlement, and Bolam's personal life history was documented as proof that she wasn't Earhart.
Oh, well, now I'm sold.
So they were able to prove without a doubt that she was not Earhart. Not to mention, if you look at pictures of them, they do not look anything alike.
Oh, no.
And plastic surgery at the time was not really a thing. So,
yeah.
So that is Amelia Earhart.
Interesting. Yeah. Very interesting.
It's.
I like the last theory. I'm still sticking with that one. Very, they went through quite lengths to squash that.
Yeah, they really did. And like I said, she filed for a $27.4 million lawsuit in today's money, which that's a lot of money. Even in today's standards, that's a lot of money. And like I said, the author pulled the books from shelves. So an out-of-court settlement, as far as I am aware, it means that he didn't have to pay that money as long as he agreed to other terms, which was probably pull the book. Don't be a jerk. Pull the book and we'll agree not to have, you pay that much money. So, and then the last thing that I'm going to talk about is Malaysian Airlines Flight 370, which is obviously the most recent on this list. And the most famous outside of Amelia Earhart. So, and I say this is the most recent because it disappeared March 8th, 2014. So that was only 6 years ago, which
the day before my birthday,
right? Which I didn't realize it was actually that long ago. I thought it was actually like 2016 or 17, but, it was 2014. So that was 6 years ago. Yeah. So the flight, which was a Boeing 777, that contained 239 passengers and crew, disappeared somewhere around the South China Sea 38 minutes after its takeoff from Kuala Lumpur International Airport en route to its destination of Beijing Capital International Airport. So it wasn't supposed to be a very long flight, and it disappeared within an hour of takeoff. So it did, like, they lost contact very, very soon after takeoff. They did notice that they flew slightly off course at one point before disappearing, but that was all they really knew. The search lasted for months and is to this day the most expensive search in aviation history, which even continued searches were conducted as recently as 2017 and 2018. So they're still trying to find it. I'm not really going to go into any more history on this simply because it's so recent and probably most of us listening to this podcast vividly remember this happening. It was covered on the news for months. So it's like,
oh yeah, it was right after I started working at the station.
Yeah. So it's like most of us probably I mean, unless some of our listeners are very, very young, most of us probably vividly remember this. So I'm not going to go into any more history. And instead, I'm just going to jump into the conspiracy theories because there's a decent amount of them. Numerous conspiracies about the plane being hijacked in one way or another were the first to arise after the plane's disappearance. These theories ranged from traditional hijacking by terrorist groups or members of the passengers, you know, hijacking the plane, to electronic hijacking, which in theory would digitally hijack the plane's security system and take over the autopilot.
Oh, wow.
You know, even remotely. Some of these hijacking theories even went as far as suggesting that the crew hijacked their own flight in a suicide mission, which has it's happened before.
Yeah,
you know, it's uncommon, yep. But it has happened before.
Mm-hmm.
The discovery of possible debris from the plane has quashed some of these theories, especially the ones that suggested they were hijacked in order to go to a different destination. Mm-hmm. But even still, they're not sure if the debris they found is specifically from this flight. Because they have found debris in the South China Sea within the past few years, but they're still unable to determine if that debris is in fact from this flight.
It's like, geez, how many planes go down that were like, is this the debris or is or is this debris from another, like, I mean, just to think about
I know that's terrifying and I hate that. So, So the fact that they have found debris has kind of put some of these hijacking conspiracies on the back burner, you know, especially the ones saying, hey, they were hijacked by a terrorist group to take them to a different country or to take these people hostage. Another possible theory is that a fire broke out in the cockpit, causing it to crash. And this theory arose from the fact that in 2011, a separate Boeing 77 had this happen on the tarmac.
Oh.
And even though fire extinguishers and fire crews were there within 3 minutes, it took over 90 minutes to put the blaze out.
Ooh,
yeah.
Wow.
So basically it was like electronic malfunctions caused a fire in the cockpit. And yeah,
and
they had,
what do you do?
I mean, they had full on firefighter crews there. And it's like, if this plane was in the air and a fire like that happened,
they couldn't
do anything about it.
No,
you know,
way interesting.
So it took 90 minutes for them to put out the fire on the ground with full firefighting teams there. So it's like, if a fire like that happened in midair, there's really nothing they could do. So that's a possibility, because it was the same model of aircraft. In another theory, Rush Limbaugh, who is an American political commentator, suggested that he thought that the flight may have been shot down.
Oh.
Now, at the time, this theory was denied and many disagreed with it and kind of poo-pooed it. But it's worth noting that later that same year, another Malaysian Airlines Boeing 777 was in fact shot down over Ukraine by surface-to-air missiles.
Mm-hmm.
So this,
I remember that.
Yeah.
We're like, we even at the station were kind of, well, that's a wow. There's a lot of planes going down right
now.
Yeah.
So because of that incident, it reignited this theory that at the time, like I said, was poo-pooed, and many kind of commented that it's a little coincidental, you know. So it's still a possibility, you know. I mean, it's like, it might have been brought up by somebody who many people just kind of say, oh, whatever, Rush, nobody cares. But now it is a possibility because it did happen to another airline from, or another plane from the same airline company. So
yeah,
it's like,
yeah,
it's possible. A Texas A&M University mathematics professor suggested in a different theory that perhaps the plane crashed into the ocean completely vertically, which would have allowed it to disappear below the surface of the water with very minimal damage, resulting in little to no debris being recovered. Because normally if a plane crashes on the water, it crashes somewhat horizontally, which causes it to splinter and explode and, you know, causes debris to be found floating. But if it completely nosedive into the water, it would cut through the surface tension.
Mm-hmm.
And could cause it to disappear with very minimal damage.
True. Just slip into the water and never be seen again.
Yeah.
That's
now,
true.
Now, the statistics of that happening are very yeah. slim, but it is theoretically possible. So, so I thought that one was interesting just from a theoretical standpoint. And then as far as the most outlandish conspiracy theories, they speculate that the plane was sucked up by a black hole.
Oh.
Which plenty quantum physicists have come out and flat out said if there was a black hole, it would have sucked up the entire planet, not just
yeah.
one singular plane. Others think that maybe it was struck by a meteor, which...
Oh.
Statistically speaking, could happen. It's.
I mean, if that happens, buy a lottery ticket.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, in the afternoon, like, holy cow. What are the chances?
A post-mortem lottery ticket.
Post-mortem lottery ticket.
But, like I said, statistically, it could happen. It's about as statistically.
I don't know about that.
It's about as statistically possible as the plane going into the water completely vertically. Yes, it's possible and plausible, but definitely more plausible than a black hole.
I mean, let's not get carried away.
And then, you know, we're going to go to my favorite theories, which is that the entire plane was abducted by aliens, time travelers, or beings from another dimension.
Well, clearly that's the answer.
So
all of the above.
E, all of the above. You know, but I like the most outlandish theories because they're just the most fun. So yeah, I don't know. But yeah, so that's all the theories for that. I'm sorry that mine was kind of long. We're at the 45-minute mark.
Jeez, I don't even have to do it. Got cryptid, guys.
I know. I'm sorry. So I am sorry this long. I didn't realize how long it was going to take.
I love it. It's been
until I like started getting wrapped up in the topic, but I do find it very fascinating how entire flights of people can just vanish without a trace. And I also find it very, very terrifying. Because like, as I probably mentioned in the Bermuda Triangle episode, the thought of crashing and sinking in the ocean is literally one of my biggest fears.
That's
and it
scary.
Terrifies me to death. Like just flying
scary.
Doesn't scare me in general. Because flying is one of the more safe ways to travel, but flying over the ocean absolutely terrifies me.
Yeah.
It really, really does. So, like, just the ocean kind of terrifies me. I won't go on cruises because I'm terrified.
What I say about, you know, not going out right now, I say, you know, because people say, like, oh, I'll take my chances with the virus. And it's like, why would you even put yourself at risk like that, because you don't know that.
That's how I am with the ocean.
But exactly. You can't get eaten by a shark if you don't go in the water.
Like,
so I'm not going to get COVID if I don't go to the store.
I don't mind going into the ocean so long as I can see the shore. You know, I don't mind that. If I can still see the shore, I can still be rescued and saved.
Yeah. Probably. Oh, yeah. But open water?
No.
Oh, no, no.
No, no, no.
No, no, no.
No, no, no. No, thank you, ma'am.
No, no, no.
I am good.
You know what I wanted to mention earlier that I thought was really interesting about the expanse of the ocean and that really gave me a perspective of just how big it is.
Right.
When I was in Hawaii, and call me ignorant. That's fine. But I was stunned that on Waikiki and like on the big island and like, you can't see the other island.
No, you can't.
Like, you can stand on the, and I, for some reason, my brain was like, yeah, sure. I mean, they knew that the archipelago was like all together. Right. But like, no, it was like, they just kind of sailed around. Oh, here. And like, there's more, there's another one. Here's another one.
Right.
But standing on the beach, you can't see the other islands for some of the islands.
Right.
But it just goes to show just how big that is.
Yeah.
It's huge.
Oh, yeah. It's massive. And as much as it's beautiful and I love it, it's absolutely terrifying. And no, thank you.
Yeah. No. No, thanks. So, well, that was really super interesting.
Thank you.
And it's time for a break.
Yes.
And we'll go get some water and we'll stretch our faces. And when we come back, I'll do our cryptid.
Sounds good.
Y'all ready for this?
God, I still love that song and will always think of Bring It On, the cheerleading movie, of that song. So, you know.
Spirit Fingers.
Thank you, early 2000s, for your Spirit Fingers.
The Spirit Fingers. Well, guys, yeah, let's do some Spirit Fingers together. Get the wiggles out.
Get the wiggles out. Wiggle your Spirit Fingers.
Ah, we feel great. It feels great to do Spirit Fingers. Like, just look at your fingers. It's just, how exciting. Oh, it's the little things, though, right, guys?
The little things. Oh,
okay, so, but speaking of little things, my topic will be much shorter. Okay. Because we've already kind of talked about the general topic of the humanoid, I would say.
Okay.
Let's specifically, we'll say Bigfoot.
Okay, yep.
At least in the United States. But there are legends of Bigfoot that exist all around the world.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. They go by different names and they're technically like different species, but yeah, yeah.
Some of them are really fun to say.
Okay.
And one of them was brought to my attention by one of our Patreon members, and his name is Jordan. Thank you, Jordan.
Thank you, Jordan.
From Australia, also one of our bigger fans is our Australian crowd.
Yes.
Hi, guys.
Australia, you're awesome. I'm not going to use an Australian accent as much
Thank
as
you.
I would like to. You're welcome.
Tessa will wag a finger at you.
You're welcome, Australians. I won't do that to you. But if you would like me to try, message me privately.
So Australia, though, has their own version of Bigfoot. That's actually goes back in to the Aboriginal culture.
Okay.
Really back.
Right.
I think this is pretty cool because it goes back so far in the legend of actually the native culture.
Okay. Very cool.
So this one, he's actually called Yowie. And it's actually more of a, they, rather than, you know, like Bigfoot, where like it's one guy or, you know, the very small group of like maybe a couple of them. This is like there's maybe two different tribes.
It's oh,
interesting.
Like herds of them or something? Or
yeah.
Interesting.
So while most are skeptical of its existence, some believe that it's an ancient species of hominid that evaded extinction. Basically, it's, like I said, the Australian Bigfoot.
Okay. Very cool.
Yowie comes to us from the outback of Australia, and that's just one name of a lot of them that are very hard to pronounce.
Okay.
That's the most fun to say, so I'm just going to keep saying Yowie, and I'm not going to try to attempt the others, just like Sammy's not going to try to attempt an Australian accent again.
You're welcome, Australia.
But Yowie's origins come from the Aboriginal oral history, and that explains those names I can't pronounce.
That's fair.
It can't really be traced in that like past written history, past the like 18 or 1700s.
Okay.
But depictions of these guys date back to the caveman days of the outback and are also known as Quinquin or a type of Quinquin, which are depicted in a rock art near Laura, Queensland.
Okay.
So they're even depicted as far back as rock art in, and they're like,
oh, wow.
That might be what they're talking about.
That's really cool.
The first time we saw the word written down, it had already been in use for a long time. It was documented in Reverend William Ridley's Kamilaroi and other Australian languages, his book. Mm-hmm. He writes, Yowie is a spirit that roams over the earth at night. So that's one of the first times we saw it, like, really written down.
Okay.
It was, like, early 1800s. It's also mentioned in the Aboriginal legend of the Yahoo, or at least compared to it. According to conspiracy author Robert Holden, an account from Europe in 1842 recorded, the natives of Australia believe in the Yahoo, which they describe as resembling a man of nearly the same height with long white hair hanging down from the head over the features, the arms as extraordinarily long, furnished at the extremities with great talons, and this is just bizarre.
Okay.
The feet turned backwards so that on flying from the man, the imprint of the foot appears as if the being had traveled in the opposite direction.
That's
altogether to describe it as a hideous monster of an unearthly character and an ape-like appearance.
That's really
What's
creepy.
What's with the feet?
That's creepy. And that reminds me of like one of those urban legends I've heard, you know, like of the woman with like the backwards feet. I don't know. I think that was an urban legend I heard, or a scary story. I don't know. But that's creepy, and I don't like that.
How do you walk on your heel? I don't get it. I don't know.
I don't either, but...
I don't know.
There's a problem afoot.
But, you're grounded. You're toeing the line, mister.
I'm sorry. I will keep my feet planted on the ground.
You have no soul. Keep your tongue in your mouth.
Oh, my God. Okay, we're done.
Lace it up.
I swear we're done. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry.
Shoot.
Foot. Okay.
Oh, man. But now that I have your attention, let's talk about what the yaoi actually looks like, according to some legends. It boils down to a hairy ape-like creature with a wide, flat nose standing upright between 6 to 12 feet tall, weighing up to 1,000 pounds, with a feet larger than a human's and a handprints or a footprints that are have inconsistent toe numbers. So there have been, like, some footprints people have found, and, like, some have four, some have five. Like, maybe that's just how people are born. Don't judge. So other groups like the one I just mentioned are in the previous account are a little bit smaller. The guy said it was only about like human size. They're maybe about 4 to 5 feet tall, but the rest of the description remains widely the same. Mm-hmm. Pretty much ape-like, really big, like weight and with feet that are larger. Usually they're described as really timid or shy. They don't really want much to do with you. In fact, there was one account, this chick was like, he was just out picking flowers in a field, just sitting there like, oh, I love my pretty little flower. Oh, if you guys are young Frankenstein fans, then please, like, let me know, because
it is a great movie.
We're kindred spirits.
I've performed a song from that before.
Aw, but some have also been reported to be kind of violent, though. And basically, if it lives, it can run hot and cold. So get over it, Henny.
Oh, my God.
Everybody can have bad days.
True. True. I've been having a lot of the bad ones lately.
Exactly. I had a rough week. Everybody has rough weeks. Right. Of the two groups, though, the Kuku Yalanji tribe, I'm going to hope I said that right, okay, of the tropical northern Queensland, Australia, believes in the yaoi. They have a long, detailed history of coexisting with them, and it's pretty much equivalent to their Bigfoot. Like, they coexist with them. They're okay. Just like, oh, yeah, no, we know that, but we just let them do their thing. Okay. Let me show you a picture. This is a wooden statue of a yaoi in Kilcoy, Queensland.
Okay.
Basically, it looks like Bigfoot.
Hang on, it hasn't. Oh, wowee!
Wowee! But yeah, I thought that was
kind of
interesting.
It is kind of Bigfoot-esque, you know?
Yeah.
Like, just that, I mean, that specific statue doesn't look as, like, hairy as Bigfoot is supposedly.
Yeah, that's true.
But
I'm going to show you another one further down in a little bit, but I'll come back to that one.
Okay.
So let's talk about some sightings, though. First, the word first white contact. I love it when they say the first contact, and then it's like, you just said for a while that the Aboriginal people live with this thing. So
right.
First white contact with the yaoi in the Northern Territory is said to have begun with the first fleet in Sydney Cove in 1788. Like I said, they showed up, and that's where we start seeing them really in the more the text, because the Aboriginal people ran into them and like, oh, yeah, beware the big guy with the hair. He's got big feet, too. Like, you
okay.
Know.
So they're just like, just don't bother him and he won't bother you.
Exactly.
Interesting.
In fact, one group was apparently out killing wallabies, rude, and said they spotted an animal that was observing them from a distance, but later claimed it was nearly twice the size and the height of an ordinary man.
Ugh.
And then it, like, just walked off. It was watching them killing wallabies, rude.
Like, oh, my God.
I mean, they're the cutest little...
They are. They're adorable. They're, you know, There are evil people, and then there are people who see evil things being done and do nothing to stop it.
That's true. It's so true. So there's also the Australian Town and Country Journal, a little magazine out there. They started running accounts of indigenous apes in the 1870s. And by 1876, they just straight up asked the readers, who has not heard from the earliest settlement of the colony, the Aboriginal people, redacted. From speaking of some unearthly animal or inhuman creature, namely the Yahoo Devil or the Hairy Man of the Wood. Also rude.
Also rude. Rude nicknames.
Rude.
Just very, very rude nicknames.
In one article appearing 6 years later, so they asked in like 1876, they're like, hey guys, you guys tell us if you've seen it. So it took 6 years for somebody to go, hey, I saw it. This guy, who was an amateur naturalist and cryptozoologist, Henry James McCooey, claimed to have seen the indigenous ape in the south coast of New South Wales. Mm-hmm. He wrote, a few days ago, I saw one of these strange creatures on the coast between the Batemans Bay and Ulladulla. I think that if it were standing perfectly upright, it would be nearly 5 feet high. It was tailless and covered with very long black hair, which was of a dirty red or snuff color about the throat and breast. Hmm. Its eyes, which were small and restless, were partly hidden by matted hair that covered its head. I threw a stone at the animal, wherein it immediately rushed off.
I mean, at least he didn't shoot at it.
I have a hard time believing that he showed that kind of restraint in the first place.
Fair. But
these white explorers, as we know, tend to shoot first and then throw rocks later.
As we've discovered throughout our four seasons of this show, it usually seems to be that the white man's response is, I see something I don't know, I shoot it. Or shoot at it. But I mean, the fact that he only threw a rock is at least some sort of testament to his restraint.
He did, however, offer to shoot the animal.
Oh, well, that's true.
Yeah,
that is
he said he would capture it for the Australian Museum for, you want to guess how much he offered him? Like, he was like, you give me this and I'll give you
$10,000?
Lower.
$100.
Lower.
Oh, God. $10.
It was 40 pounds.
Okay. I don't, that's British money.
I don't know what that is for inflation at the time, but I don't think that's very much. That's still not very much.
You keep talking. I will figure it out and I will get back to you.
Sam is going to go do the research that I should have done.
I will. You go, you do what you need to do and I will figure it out.
Back to our buddy, though, Robert Holden, I mentioned earlier, who is a modern author, an expert on these things. He said that a second outbreak of sightings also happened around 1912. There's actually photo evidence of this guy.
Okay.
Much like Bigfoot, it's pretty grainy and distorted, but there's no denying that there's definitely something in this photo that's a little odd. It's a snap from 1936, a part of a series of photos taken by Rich Jones while working at a loggers camp in Batlow in the mountains of New South Wales. That's like a little less than 300 miles from Sydney, or about 450 kilometers.
Okay.
It shows a large individual sitting with his hands in his lap behind two men sitting on a wooden log. Now, this guy is in the background of two men sitting closer, technically, to the camera, and he's huge. And I'm going to show you this picture here.
Okay, what year was that one where he wanted 40 pounds?
Oh, that happened in, let's see, that would have been 1882.
Okay. Oh, God, that's a lot.
40 pounds.
So in today's money, that would be 4,640 pounds or $5,675.74.
Wow, so a pretty good little chunk of change for it.
Yeah, at least at the time. Yeah. So it seems like
it's funnier to think I'll give me 40 bucks for it.
Yeah, when you think of it like, you know, oh, I want 40 bucks for it. It's like, that's like not much. But no, he was asking for a decent chunk of change. So, okay.
To go hunt that thing down. So, but anyway, here's the, this guy. So this is what they're claiming is the Yowie sitting
behind.
So these two guys are in the foreground here, and this guy's behind them technically.
And they like posed with him, or they didn't know he was there.
They didn't really to explain the photo, at least. But yeah, apparently this was part of a logging camp, so it could have been that he worked at the camp and he was just sitting there.
And he was just chilling, just hanging out. Okay.
Yeah, could be entirely intelligent people. Like, who knows?
Maybe he worked at the logging camp.
Exactly.
Or they. So, sorry. Once again, I need to normalize pronouns more. They might have worked at the logging camp with the humans. Interesting.
A more recent and somewhat well-known sighting happened much later, though, in December 1979. Leo and Patricia George went out into the forest and found the body of a mutilated kangaroo and realized that the attacker was only a mere 40 feet away. They described it as a creature 10 feet tall, covered with hair, that looked back to glare at them before disappearing off into the brush.
If anything 10 feet tall glared at me, I would be the one running off into the brush.
I might pee myself. Yeah.
Like I said, I would be the one turning tail and running off into the brush if some giant 10-foot tall creature glared at me. Nope. Bye. Sorry. I did not mean to intrude.
There's even a modern expert on the Yowie, Rex Gilroy, who claims to have investigated over 3,000 modern cases and believes the Yowie is related to the North American Bigfoot. He also, and that it's like a an offshoot, different, like, another species. Right. Like you said, that there's, like, different accounts of it all over the world by different names.
Right.
But
right.
maybe just cousins of each other. Like, you know, the squirrels that live on different islands, but they were once the same squirrel, but right. now they're two different squirrels.
Yeah.
You know.
I mean, but, that would also explain, like, the Yeti and stuff like that. Where exactly. It's like, or the abominable snowman. It's like they're probably all offshoots of the same, like, genus, but they're different mm-hmm. species within that genus. I got you.
Yeah. Yeah. Also interesting that that he has investigated about 3,000 cases, because there's one website that claims that there's been about a little over 3,100 cases of Bigfoot sightings that have been investigated over 92 years. So
in Australia alone, or just worldwide?
Of Bigfoot.
Okay. Yeah. Specifically Bigfoot. So, gotcha.
Specifically Bigfoot versus Australia's Bigfoot. They're roughly about the same. But
interesting.
There's the study of Yowie has gone on a lot longer.
Gotcha. That's really fascinating.
Yeah. But the conclusion, basically, I'm not really going to go into what it could be, because you guys can take your guess. We know Bigfoot.
Right.
No bones have ever really been found. The tracks are really rare, although, they're usually different when they are found. Mm-hmm. And there's very little visual evidence that actually exists aside from that photo. Although we have, seen some stuff hints at it. So
true.
But nice and short and sweet. That is the Yowie. I guess kind of a little glancing over of our another Bigfoot friend from around the world.
Very interesting. And once again, thank you, Jordan, for
thanks, Jordan,
for giving us the idea to talk about that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And honestly, if any of you guys, want to reach out to us and give us ideas, we're not opposed to, like, hearing your stories and possibly talking about your ideas on the air. We'd love that.
Absolutely. So if you bring it to us, there's a chance we may cover it. If there is an option on our Patreon, if you guys want to be a guaranteed pick.
Oh, yeah.
You guys can go head on over there.
That
and,
is a thing. I forgot
you guys
about
can have a thing.
I forgot yes. about those tiers. But yes, there are two tiers. I don't remember which dollar amount, but there are two tiers on our Patreon. One of them is you get to pick one of our topics and we are guaranteed to talk about it. And the other one is you pick both of our topics and we are both going to talk about it. So you'll have basically a whole episode that is your episode. So
that is
out there if anybody's interested, but you don't have to do that, but out there if you'd like to.
But if you guys want to offer us suggestions, we will always take them. And
yeah,
sometimes I do.
Absolutely.
We do run through them because we all run out of ideas sometimes. Yeah. And you guys have wonderful ones.
And
all
at
the
very
time.
Least, we're going to read it and we will, yeah. We're doing our best to respond to like every email or Facebook message we get because, at least me right now, I've got a lot of time on my hands. But just in general, I enjoy interacting with you guys. So,
absolutely.
If you reach out to us, I'm going to do my best to write back to you because that's fun. So yeah,
absolutely.
But,
so that wraps up this episode. Next episode is our swap-isode, guys. That means we get to go back to our normal chairs.
That means I get
I'm very excited to share mine with you guys.
I get
so
to
excited.
Put my own shoes back on.
I know. Just make sure left goes on the left.
Left goes
on
the left
right.
Foot. Right goes on the right. And the left foot, I have to make
yes.
my left hand because
exactly.
it makes an L. Okay.
You could remember how to put shoes on. I'm so happy. So glad you remember how to go outside.
If only I could tie them.
If only. Oh, that's. If somebody can help Sammy tie his shoes.
I've got a SpongeBob episode to teach me how to do that. I'll be fine.
That's true. That's true. Oh, but, man. Okay. So I think, are we business
stuff? I don't think so. I think we've talked about everything and said thank you to everything. Yeah, we'll be back June 1st for, an episode. So we've got two more episodes left this season until we take our July hiatus. But yeah, thank you guys as always for listening. We love and appreciate you all. You're amazing. And
keep washing your hands, wearing your masks, staying social distancing and everything.
Keep practicing proper safety procedures.
And don't forget,
Big Brother is watching.
Thank you so much for joining us for another episode of Conspiracies and Cryptids with Sammy and Tessa. Don't forget to check out our website, www.conspiriesandcryptids.com, for more episodes and other information.
And if you're really enjoying what we're doing, check out our Patreon at patreon.com/cryptipod. That's CRYPTIPOD. There you can find different ways to support us and get some awesome goodies along the way.
While you're at it, you can also find us on all of your favorite social media platforms like Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. That's any one of those at Cryptopod.
And if you're enjoying our podcast, please think about leaving us a 5-star review on iTunes. Leave us 5 stars and a nice little blurb about why you like us. It helps us to gain some traction and find some new listeners.
And while you're at it, don't forget to tell your friends, because our friends are your friends.
And don't forget, Big Brother is watching.